See, this is the official printer. But the first one here, as my laser printer was confiscated at the Stockholm airport a couple of years ago, it's apparently illegal to carry a green laser printer in your carry-on luggage in the Swedish airspace. So, for those of you heading to Stockholm University in the near future, put your laser printer in your check-in baggage.
Is it wavelength specific?
Yeah, there are different codes for different wavelengths.
Yeah. Selection.
Next night, remember. It's work.
Great. So let me get started. I should say, first of all, if you have questions during the talk, please interrupt me. It's much more useful to get those things taken care of immediately than have like a lot of confused people at the end of the talk. So please interrupt me as much as you want. I don't know if that's a dangerous thing to say.
It's a little bit.
All right. So I'm going to be talking a bit about dark matter detection and how we learn about dark matter from these myriad observations and experiments that are ongoing and are proposed for the next decade or so. All right, so probably to this audience, I don't need to spend a lot of time talking about why we think there's dark matter. But I think suffice it to say, from observations on different scales, from galaxies to the whole universe and at different redshifts, that it's just really hard to make our universe work without dark matter. And we also know approximately how much of it there is in order for this picture to work out well. Alright, so even though we know that there's a lot of dark matter in the universe and we know pretty well how much of it there is, we don't know what it is. So there are some ideas. For a while, these astrophysical candidates, such as primordial black holes or massive compact halo objects, were quite popular. That's relatively disfavored these days from a variety of observations. Anywhere from looking at microlensing in our galaxy to looking at Big Bang nucleus synthesis. Fortunately, theorists are very creative and have postulated a slew of potential dark particle physics dark matter candidates. So of these, this class of candidate called the weakly interacting massive particle, which by massive, it means sort of more than a proton mass, and weakly interacting means about weak scale interactions. This is probably the most popular class. A lot of candidates in this class arise naturally from extensions to the standard model. And it's relatively easy to make this work with what we observe about dark matter. But there are a whole bunch of other candidates. Just as a warning, a lot of what I'm going to be talking about is sort of WIMP specific, but not entirely. And a lot of the ideas behind what I'm doing generalize to these other candidates too.
What does Kaluza-Klein photon mean?
That's the so in these universal extra dimension models, you have some sort of compact, at least one extra dimension, and it's sort of the first momentum state going on there, the photon. Well, actually, it would be, they call it the Kaluza-Klein photon. All right.
That might carry a charge associated with this extra dimension.
Yeah, it usually carries a discrete, it's a discrete symmetry, so, yeah, it carries Kaluza, what they call Kaluza-Klein charge.
So won't that produce repulsion, or is it too weak? I mean, would that ruin its property as a kind of dust line?
It would be electromagnetically charged if it's Kaluza-Klein theory, but there are many varieties in such models.
Yes.
So it doesn't have to be.
It's a weak scale particle. It's a weak scale particle, and it's not charged under regular electromagnetism.
Oh,
it does give an exchange, but it's a weak scale interaction. So
really beats it.
The radius is small, and so the mass are in width scale, and so it's a heavy part. Right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you can exchange by it, but it's
okay.
Probably not in exchange because it's stable. So.
Well, perhaps we should move on. All right, so there are essentially four different ways to try to figure out what the dark matter is. For one thing, you can try to make it so for a lot of these WIMP or these extensions to standard model theories, one would hope to create particles of those theories in something like the LHC. So this is a nice little picture of the LHC from a talk by Eric Priebus. Right. Secondly, you can hope to detect it directly. So this is another figure I pulled from someone else's talk. The idea is that you have some sort of particle from the galaxy streaming into some sort of detector, interacting with one of the nuclei in the detector, and then the WIMP or the other particle wanders off. But then you hope to measure the energy that the WIMP deposits into your detector. Thirdly, you can hope to detect or figure out what dark matter is by its decays or annihilations to standard model particles. So this is a picture of supersymmetric neutralinos interacting and producing quite a shower of particles. So I'll be talking a little bit about this later, looking for neutrinos from such an annihilation, but you can of course look for any of these standard model particles and people. And the fourth way that we can try to figure out what dark matter, the composition of dark matter is by looking at these, they're called gravitational probes. So for example, looking at lensing of galaxies or clusters, or even looking at the microlensing due to substructures within there. Looking at rotation curves, or in the case of sort of pressure-supported systems, looking for the velocity and dispersion of stars. And this is interesting because different dark matter candidates, can potentially give different signals for these things. All right, so the main point is that the main point for now is that these last three methods of looking for dark matter, we're really looking for astrophysical dark matter. So dark matter that's been around, you know, for the age of the universe, it's participated in galaxy evolution. And even if you make something in a collider, if you want to make sure that what you see in that collider is actually the dark matter or one of the dominant species for dark matter, you need to also detect some of these astrophysical dark matter particles to make sure that you have a consistent picture. So to sort of put the astrophysics part of looking for dark matter to a framework, I created these pseudo-equations, which might be somewhat heretical here, but nevertheless, I'm an astrophysicist for you. So we see some sort of signal, and it's essentially some combination of particle physics of dark matter multiplied by the dark matter's astrophysical properties.
So do they commute in each
other? I think they're more entwined than should maybe be like some sort of convolution all right, so what we really want is we want to know the particle physics properties of the dark matter. That's the thing we really want to get out of this. And we have some sort of signal, but in order to really map between the particle physics and the signal, we need to know something about the astrophysics of the dark matter. All right, so this is just emphasizing we really need to understand the astrophysics of dark matter in order to actually understand the particle physics of dark matter. All right, and so an example of where not really understanding the astrophysics of dark matter can lead you to not terribly conclusive results about the particle physics of dark matter. I'm just going to give a recent example from the Fermi collaboration. So the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope has been taking data for over a year now. It's sensitive to gamma rays sort of between 300 MeV to almost a TeV or so. And they've recently published a number of papers on limits on the annihilation cross-section of WIMP dark matter to gamma rays. So one of the ways that they try to set this limit is that they look at the diffuse isotopic background. And they're specifically looking for essentially any gamma ray that has ever come from annihilation of dark matter since the beginning of the universe. So this signal, this flux per unit energy, essentially depends on the number of gamma rays that you get, or the energy spectrum and number of gamma rays that you get in a dark matter halo with mass m at redshift z. And that's really the annihilation cross-section times the integral over the density square of the dark matter halo times the various branching fractions and the energy spectrum per annihilation. You multiply that by the mass function of dark matter halos as a function of mass and redshift. Then there's some sort of attenuation term because gamma rays in the early universe can collide with photons that have been produced, say, in starbursts, and then pair produce. So you lose that gamma ray. Then you integrate sort of over all of the universe. And that's essentially your signal. All right, and so there are some uncertainties, for example, with this attenuation optical depth. And this mass function here depends on cosmology. Depending on sigma h, or essentially the power spectrum fluctuations, you can get a mass function that varies enough that you get differences of order factors of several in the flux. But I'm going to be talking about just the uncertainty in the distribution of dark matter in the halos to illustrate this point. All right, so from n-body simulations, we have a pretty good idea of what the smooth dark matter density profile is in halos, at least down to a few hundred parsecs in a galaxy-sized halo. But dark matter halos are not, I mean, dark matter is not the only thing in dark matter halos. You've got a lot of baryons, you have galaxies, you have gas. And it's not entirely clear what happens to that smooth density profile when you put in the processes of galaxy evolution. Moreover, the dark matter halo is perhaps not the only macrostructure, and I'll be talking about this dark disk later, but the point for now is that the halo may not be the only big structure surrounding the galaxy. Then there are issues of microstructure. So in our hierarchical picture of structure formation, big halos are formed out of little halos. And we don't really know how those little halos populate big halos. Moreover, we don't have a really precision idea of what happens to the debris that results from when these substructures fall into the halo and then disrupt or interact with stars with the baryons. All right, so what are the consequences for this Fermi attempt to place a limit on the annihilation cross-section of using all gamma rays from anything that is ever annihilated? So in this plot, we have the WIMP mass in GeV on this axis, and the annihilation cross-section to BV bar in units of centimeter cubed per second. These two plots just show two different ways of setting limits. These are some supersymmetric models, or points in the supersymmetric parameter space. And these different 95% confidence limits come from different assumptions about the density distribution of dark matter in halos. And so you can see that depending on what you assume, or essentially how you extrapolate from existing simulations, you get a 3 to 4 order of magnitude spread in the limit. And that's not so informative. I mean, if we really believe this limit down here, that would tell us that we're already ruling out a lot of points of supersymmetric parameter space. But if we're up here, I mean, in a sense, who cares? I mean, so the question is, what do we do with this astrophysical uncertainty in the dark matter? And I'll be focusing really in this talk on the essentially the phase-based density of dark matter. But there are other astrophysical properties of dark matter, or rather astrophysics that can happen to its decay products or annihilation products, which is also quite important, but I'm not going to touch on it. That's a whole other kettle of fish. All right. So there are essentially two different ways we can try to understand the astrophysical uncertainties in dark matter. We can either do better modeling, or we can essentially treat our lack of knowledge as something that we want to cull or constrain better from data, and try to do that as we also try to get out the particle physics properties of dark matter. And really, the trick is to figure out which approach is probably going to be more useful, and then see how those two approaches will work together, and also how, in the case of data analysis, how to best parameterize the problem. Okay, so I'm going to walk through some examples of how both the modeling and the sort of data mining approach can both be quite useful, and how they are actually complementary in some ways. So I'm going to focus my examples on dark matter in the solar system, because probes of the local dark matter are touted as being really great discovery, having really great discovery potential. All right, so the first thing I'll talk about is an example of modeling. And I'm going to be talking in this case about the thermalization of wimp dark matter in the sun. All right, so what is that? So this picture, you have some sort of wimp from the galactic halo streaming through the sun. It scatters, and if the wimp scatters onto an orbit that is bound to the sun, it sort of circles around again and again, keeps scattering off the nuclei in the sun, eventually forms a dense core at the center of the sun. That dense core is important because the annihilation rate goes as the square of the density. So you really want to put all your wimps in one place to get a big signal. Also, then it becomes a point source, and that's just better too. All right, so then the wimps can annihilate, and annihilate into all these different standard model particles. But of those, only the neutrinos escape from the surface of the sun and the things that we can see. And then these neutrinos propagate to the Earth, and then we can maybe detect them using neutrino telescopes. So this propagation stuff has been worked on quite a bit, so that is pretty nailed down. So there are papers by Blenoff and Barger and Chiarelli where they really do this calculation from the point of annihilation to detecting stuff on Earth very carefully. And I'm going to talk about the part of the problem that has historically been thought to be the easy part, but is actually not. All right, so what people thought was the easy part is estimating the annihilation rate of dark matter to anything. So in the standard picture, it's thought that wimps basically thermalize with the solar nuclei on very short time scales. And then for sort of realistic cross-sections, the annihilation rate and the capture rate sort of come into equilibrium. And if you have self-annihilating particles, that means that the annihilation then is just half of the capture rate. Once people did this calculation, and also did some stuff with the eventual neutrino spectrum, they got pretty excited because it looked like this had some pretty good discovery potential. Namely, in the standard model, neutrinos from annihilation of rings in the sun produce the strongest constraint on the width proton spin dependent cross section. So this is a plot that I pulled from one of the Ice Cube papers. So Ice Cube, if you don't know, is this approximately cubic kilometer experiment at the South Pole. They instrument the Antarctic cap with photomultiplier tubes and then basically look for Cherenkov radiation from either muons, they get a lot of atmospheric muons, or from neutrino-induced muons. So, all right, so this is the cross-section, this is the mass. These are the current ice cube limits. This is from just a year of data when the detector was only about a fifth or a quarter deployed. This is a limit from the Super K collaboration, and these are direct detection limits. This is someone's scan of supersymmetric parameter space. And so these limits are just starting to become interesting for that. When IceCube is fully deployed and runs for 5 years, the limit should be more downrange here. They also will have a low threshold extension, so that will bring the limits sort of to look like that.
Why there is a feature on the Super K one?
It depends on what they assume that the major branching was for the annihilation. For Ice Cube, they just put two different limits, assuming W plus, W minus, or VB bar. They don't try to sort of guess which branching is going to be most important. Okay, so the point of this plot is that there's a lot of discovery potential, so we sort of like to get that annihilation calculation right. So the reason that that standard model is not so correct, there are actually a couple of...
So can I explain?
Yeah.
So are you suggesting that the neutrino experiments are much better than all these direct detections?
For this channel, yes. And in a lot of the Kaluza quantum type theories and a lot of MSSM parameter space, you generally predict that the spin-dependent cross-sections will be substantially higher than the spin-independent. And most direct detection experiments are really focused on getting the spin-independent cross-section. So, I mean, IceCube is already doing orders of magnitude better than the direct detection experiments, and it's only going to do better.
So can you explain whether that is, I never heard, I didn't know much about it. So why is this, why are neutrinos much more sensitive to spin-dependent?
Because the sun is made up mostly of hydrogen.
Uh-huh.
And that has a spin dependent thing because it has just one proton.
Okay.
So basically, it's that you have a huge ball of target pretty close by. All right, so let me show you how the standard model is wrong. So even if the sun were a totally isolated body, the winds don't thermalize with the solar nuclei immediately. The typical time scale between scatters goes as the wind period divided by the optical depth through one passage through the sun. Okay, and especially high mass winds, they can't lose very much energy in a given scatter. So they have to scatter many, many times in order to reach the center of the potential of the sun. Secondly, winds, especially high mass winds, when they are initially captured to the solar system, are captured onto orbits that have fairly long semi-major axes, so much so that the planets can perturb these orbits and potentially pull those particles out of the sun. So basically what this means is that you need to do a much more involved calculation to estimate the annihilation rate that comes from the sun. And this is something that I did while I was still at Princeton. So what I did is I simulated the orbits of about 1.5 million particles from their initial scatter in the sun that made them bound to the solar system till they became what I deemed uninteresting. So either that their orbit was very short, or that they were ejected from the solar system, or that 4.5 billion years had gone by. I did a realistic Monte Carlo scattering in the sun, took very great care that the orbit integration was stable for 5 billion years. And I did this in a simple solar system in order to better understand the results, and also because there's a constant motion in the restricted three-body problem. And that was a good check, since I had to basically write all this code from scratch to make sure that my algorithm was stable. You can see these papers if you want to know more. But as a warning, this first one is like 45 pages long, and I don't know anyone other than me who's gotten through it.
You just threw out something about it. Extra constant of the motion in the restricted three-body problem. What was that?
There is a constant of motion in the system, the Jacobi constant. Mm-hmm. And so I tracked that in the integrations, and I conserved it to basically part in 10 to the 6 or 10 to the 7 for 5 billion years. So,
what kind of symmetry is associated with this?
Which symmetry? So, I mean, it's the it's not like a
it's not an obvious symmetry.
No,
it's time translation variance in the rotating frame where the planet stays at the same longitude.
I should say just energy in that rotating frame.
Oh, this is...
Yeah, if you go to a rotating frame where Jupiter stays here.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, this is some restricted tree body where one is very light compared to the...
One is much more massive. Is that what's restricted?
It's a circular orbit. So.
But Vinks are much less massive.
I know. Are you sure?
Otherwise, it won't be here.
Sorry, what is restricted three body? What does that mean?
So it's in a plane, and the two big things are in the plane, right. And they're on a circular orbit around it. Yes?
The issue of the amount of dark matter in the solar system. We're sitting 8 kiloparsecs from the center of the Milky Way galaxy.
Yeah.
If you look at rotation curves in the Milky Way, they're already flattening out at this point.
Yes.
And you need a factors of 2 or so to get from Newton to a rotation curve. Because Newton doesn't agree with the Newtonian gravity. Mm-hmm. So you can get an idea of how much dark matter you need to get the flat rotation curve. Because we're sitting in the Earth, you see.
Yes.
But there are limits on how much dark matter you can have in the solar system before it starts becoming unstable.
Yeah.
How do you match these two?
So, I mean, I do like a full calculation of how much there is. I mean, I don't try to set limits. I just try to calculate given some sort of phase space density of the galactic dark matter, how much of it there actually is in the solar system.
They have to match.
Presumably there's not much danger of it driving the solar system unstable.
No, I mean, if you believe that the local dark matter density is about 0.3 or 1 GeV per cubic centimeter, you end up only with like at most an asteroid amount of mass in the solar system. So it's completely negligible.
Too bad.
Yeah, now, there have been many like optimistic papers written, but I hate to burst their bubble, but nevertheless.
So what was wrong with those papers? They just calculated the three-body capture and not
ejection.
Ejection.
And ejection is very important in the solar system. Right. Just ask any planetary physicist, astronomer.
And So, but can you use some additional, like, fourth body to I don't know, how it works. So you have two planets, right? And then
it's one planet.
Yeah,
the sun and the planet, right? And you capture it using some three-body process.
Yeah.
And then
reject it.
And then
right, I understand, but can you use the perturbation from some yet another planet to somehow bring it on a stable trajectory, or it's just...
It's just really not stable. I mean, you just throw stuff out.
Never stable, right?
You can capture some things or that are close to resonances, or you can capture things onto resonances, but you can also eject things from those. I mean, for any process, you have to include the inverse process, and you're just never going to get huge amounts of stuff if you take both into account. All right, but I should probably move on because I'm running behind at this point.
You did ask for it.
Yeah, and it's quite enjoyable. Okay, so when I did these simulations, I found essentially three types of behavior. So for winds that were initially scattered onto semi-major axes of less than about 1.5 AU. I mean, they just thermalize like as if the sun were a solitary body. So the typical time between scatters was just the wind period divided by the altitude. And then at high semi-major axes, so when the aphelion of the orbit approaches Jupiter, then you just throw stuff out on very short time scales. So the time scale to pull the perihelion of such an orbit out of the sun is just a few thousand years. So unless the cross-section for wind scattering is incredibly high, you will just lose all the Jupiter crossing of this. And in the middle, you have this region where there's this tension between the eventual chaos and this very regular system, where the winds feel the effects of mean motion resonances and also secular resonances. And in that case, those resonances can pull the perihelion out of the sun for a while, and that increases the time to scatter by about a factor of 300 over these smaller orbits. And again, the effect is greater for higher wind masses just because you put more things onto planet crossing orbits, and then it just takes a long time to thermalize. So for sort of a standard galactic dark matter population, when you consider that that's the population scattering on the sun, you can quantify the effects as follows. So in this case, I'm showing the wind mass and the spin independent wind proton cross section on this axis. Here I just consider spin dependent scattering. And for really high cross sections in both cases, basically, the standard capture and annihilation calculation is fine. But as soon as you hit this green zone, which is already actually quite high cross sections, you lose all the Jupiter crossing orbits. And then in this purple region, you lose all of these sort of like these particles that really feel the tension between the various resonances. And in these red areas, you start losing even the WIMPs on small orbits, just because the time between scatters is so long. Okay, and what does this mean for the new annihilation calculation? So in these plots, I'm showing the annihilation rate that I calculate first over the standard annihilation calculation as a function of wind mass. And again, this is for spin-independent scattering. This is for spin-dependent scattering. And you can see that you don't get that much suppression if wind or spin-independent scattering dominates. And that's because the typical nucleus then that a wind scatters off of is oxygen, which is fairly massive compared to hydrogen. In this case, winds are only scattering really off of hydrogen. So up here, you're losing the Jupiter crossers. Here, you're starting to lose these 1.5 to 2.6 AU orbits. Here, you're losing the Jupiter crossers. And then once you lose the 1.5 to 2.68 orbits. And the one that asks is about a QTV, basically it was everything.
For 10 to the minus 43, the ice cubes in the Antares are sizing for those?
They're getting close, yeah. So ice cube will probably get down to below 10 to minus 41. So this is starting to become important. And again, this is in a crude solar system. If you put in inner planets in particular, it's likely to change this and drive the annihilation rate even lower. Okay, so these are some implications for ice cube. This is a figure I took from a paper by Wikstrom and Ezio from a year ago or so. And in these plots, they've only incorporated the effects of losing the Jupiter crossings. And the limit they get on the cross section for a given flux from the sun, or lack of, or I should say flux limit, they get a much less optimistic limit on the cross section than in the case of standard annihilation, which are these lower lines. And each of these different pairs of lines corresponds to a different annihilation channel. Okay, so the summary so far is that when you calculate the annihilation rate of WIMPs in the sun, you're trying to calculate event rates for something like ice cube or these Mediterranean experiments. You actually need to do some solar system simulations. And in fact, you suppress the annihilation rate by a lot, especially for the hiding masses. But the point for the sort of scheme that I've been talking about of modeling versus, you know, trying to learn something from the data, I think you can actually get very accurate mappings between the particle physics properties of WIMPs and the signal if you do these simulations very realistically. And in my current work, I'm adding in the inner planets to try to get a much better lifetime distribution of WIMPs in the solar system. Okay, so that's the first part of my talk. Usually I'm a little bit farther by now, but I also usually don't get so many questions. So next I'm going to talk a bit about what you can learn from data mining. In this case, I'm going to talk about the galactic phase space density of dark matter at the position of the solar system. First, I'm going to convince you that we actually don't really know what it should be that well, and then show how you can potentially get it out of the data.
Before you go, can I ask, do the gravitational dynamics have any implications for direct detection? Because you might expect that it affects the distribution of WIMPs.
Yeah, so that was actually the main reason why I did these simulations. And I found that the population is just very small, so it had almost no observable effect.
Have you thought of looking at very, very light particles, like axions, whose occupation number is huge, so you can consider the axion change in the quantum.
Yeah, so I you know, occasionally thought a little bit about it, but I haven't done it. Yeah, I mean, the main thing that would change there are the interactions inside the sun, to some extent. So, yeah, so I thought a bit about it, but I have not done it. Okay. So, let me just quickly describe the other types of experiments that are sensitive to dark matter in the solar system. First is direct detection, which I touched on briefly in the introduction. In this case, the event rate of nuclear recoils per unit energy that the nucleus gets as a result of the WIMP interaction basically goes as the integral of the phase space density times the velocity times the cross section. And this cutoff speed here cut basically corresponds to the minimum speed a WIMP has to have in order to give an energy P to some nucleus of mass MA. And thus, mu squared is just the square of the reduced mass. Okay. Just to give you a taste of how the phase space density and the WIMP mass and the cross section all combined together to give you an event rate. this is sort of a big plot that I made for myself. The event rate is a function of recoil energy. Each column corresponds to a different min mass, and each row corresponds to a different lag speed of the wind distribution from the Earth. And in this case, I just assumed a Maxwellian distribution function for the winds. And each different line on these plots corresponds to a different velocity dispersion of the winds. So you can see that depending on all these properties, you get a different spectrum. But what you should also see is that a lot of these lines look awfully similar. And I'll touch more on that later. Okay. And then just like you can have the capture and annihilation of WIMPs in the sun, you can also have that in the Earth. And the goal with all of these experiments is first just to see something, but then to figure out like the WIMP mass and various cross-sections. But in order to do that, we need to understand this space-based density. So perhaps you've seen a plot like this, where direct detection experiments typically like to display the results in this form, where WIMP mass is on this axis, and the WIMP nucleon, in this case spin-independent cross-section, is on this axis. This is a plot I pulled from the recent CDMS germanium experiment. These red and black lines are their most recent limits. But the question is, what does this exclusion limit actually mean? And what usually people do in order to translate their null results to some sort of particle physics is that they essentially assume that the galactic halo can be described as a singular isothermal sphere. So some sort of spherical density distribution where the density goes as distance from the galactic center to minus 2, and where everything is phased, mixed, ergodic, and with an isotropic velocity dispersion, which is related to the local rotation curve as such. Here, the sub O dot is the speed of the sun about the galactic center, or actually, if it were on a purely circular orbit. So this is what usually people put in to make their exclusion limits. But the question is, what happens when we relax this assumption? And what happens if we actually like see real events that we really believe are dark matter events? So this was looked at a little bit by Strigari and Trotta last year, where they basically had parameterized forms for the galactic potential, including the galactic dark matter halo. And then they assumed that you had some sort of direct detection experiment that saw something, and that you also had a collection of halo stars for which you had kinematic data and could constrain the galactic potential with that. So these different curves correspond to different assumptions about the dark matter halo. So these black curves are the errors on the WIMP mass and cross-section if you believe you know the local dark matter distribution function perfectly. What you can see is that even though these error bars are really small, if you get your halo model wrong, you're going to be highly biased, and so your error bars will not mean anything. And these different blue and green curves correspond to different numbers of parameters in the number of host rates. So you can see that at least at this point, all the error ellipses are centered on the same point, but of course now they're much larger because you've included the more of the uncertainty in the local dark matter distribution function. But there are additional complications. So from these, from the stellar kinematics in that Strigari and Trotta paper, you can get the density profile maybe at the dark matter distribution, but you don't know the velocities of the dark matter particles. Secondly, the halo is not the only macro structure that we might have in the Milky Way. So there were some simulations by Justin Reed and also some by Chris Purcell, who is a graduate student at UCI, where I is Irvine, where they looked at satellite galaxies that get thrown into the Milky Way halo, or halos sort of like the Milky Way. And what they find is that if you have a disk galaxy in the halo, the gravitational interactions between the satellites and the disk mean that the satellites sort of get dragged into the disk frame of the galaxy, where they then dissolve and form not quite a disk-like structure, but they call it a disk because it's sort of like flatter than halo. It actually looks more like trumpet-shaped, but it's a different matter. So the reason that this is important is that a lot of the dark matter particles from the satellite galaxies end up with fairly low speeds with respect to stars in the disk. And things that are slow are just easy to capture gravitationally. So as an example of like why this such a dark disk might matter, here I show a plot from a paper that I wrote with some people at the University of Zurich, including Justin Reed. This column I show some predicted neutrino-induced muon fluxes through neutrino telescopes for the case of just a halo. And here is sort of a typical dark disk that was found in Justin's simulations. So these are for fluxes from the Earth, from capture and annihilation of the Earth. The differences between these two rows is just what you assume about the very slowest particles in the solar system. And the point I want to make is, so these lines here are different like exclusion curves or predicted exclusion curves from neutrino telescopes. And you can use that to sort of guide your eye. The scales are the same on both plots. And these points are some sort of sampling of constrained minimal supersymmetric parameter space. What you can see is that the event rate, if you have a dark disk of neutrinos from capture and annihilation in the Earth, is orders of magnitude higher. So that's pretty interesting and something that we would need to be aware of when we do eventual data analysis. Okay, so those were some macroscopic complications. There are also microscopic yes?
Before you move away from the dark disk, it seems naively I would think that what was a boon for the annihilation would be a disaster for the direct detection. Because if we're moving, if the dark matter is basically moving with the sun now, wouldn't that mean a severe reduction in direct detection rates? Because the dark matter wind is no longer as strong?
No, because it's not the wind so much as, well, you get a different spectrum of events. It's not that you get like drastically lower or higher numbers of events, except the spectrum of the events is quite different.
So, I mean, so the disk is not really like co-rotating with the sun. It's
It's not always. And, you know, whether or not to call it a disk, you know, that's a different question. I mean, in these papers, they usually look at the few most massive satellites that end up plunging through disks. And of course, there's still problems with simulations in terms of resolution. You have some particles that are really counter-rotating, and those you just are hard to see with any method. Okay, so there are also complications with microstructure, which Niyayesh has worked on a bit recently. But depending on who you ask, you hear either, oh, we just don't need to worry about the microstructure in the halo, to some people saying, well, actually, yes, it could be quite important. But the reality is, we can't simulate those scales. Okay, so now that I've hopefully convinced you that there is actually quite a bit of uncertainty about the local phase space density, now I want to explain what you can actually do about it. So the ansatz is that at some point we will actually see something that more than just the Dalma collaboration will do. So the approach that I've taken is really inspired by sort of cosmological data analysis. And I don't actually know if no one has applied this to dark matter. But the idea is basically that no experiment is going to tell you everything about dark matter. So what you want to do is basically have some giant data set of all the different experiments, each with different degeneracies in the dark matter parameter space. And then you want to have as minimal as possible theoretical priors on what the velocity distribution is. And as an aside, these dark matter experiments are the only things actually sensitive to the full local 3D, or sorry, 16 free space density. So, like, that's where our data are coming from, both for particle physics and for the free space density. All right, so as a test of principle of some of these ideas, I wrote a pretty simple paper back in the fall, where I just considered the large direct detection experiments that are expected to be available in the next 5 to 10 years. And I chose the experiments that were the easiest to model, just because I wanted to get an idea if these ideas would work. I did a pretty simple Fisher matrix analysis, which I'm now actually doing Markov chain Monte Carlo explorations of parameter space. I assumed a single dark matter particle species. And the theoretical prior that I did put in is that the dark matter is some sort of Maxwellian velocity distribution. And working with the student, we're currently really relaxing that. That's sort of as a first pass. I wanted to see what would happen if you assumed something about the velocity distribution but did not require that it be halo-like. So, for example, I let the lag speed between the dark matter distribution and us just be a free parameter, and also the velocity dispersion. Okay, and here's the first results. So in this column, there are the 2015 era experiments, this column 2020. This A parameter is really a spin-independent cross-section times the local mass density of dark matter. And these are the model input parameters. These various colors for the different experiments correspond to the colors on the plots. So these are sort of the 2015 era experiments, sort of like tongue scale direct detection experiments. The 2020 era experiments are more 10 tongue scale experiments, except for germanium, which is 1 ton here and about 100 kilograms here. And in this plot, if the whip mass versus this A parameter, which is essentially a measure of the cross-section. This yellow line corresponds to the 1 sigma limit on these two parameters with the 2015 era, and this black for the 2020 era experiments. So you can see that 2015, you're not going to get that much. 2020, it looks pretty good. Here I put in a prior, if the LHC can figure out what the wimp is, and figure out its mass to about 10%. If you put in that prior, then these are the one sigma ellipses, where this yellow ellipse is using the combined data set with all these 2015-era experiments. And that's something similar for 2020. And as a comparison, these plots are the error bars you would get if you assume that you knew the local distribution function perfectly. So you can see that, in general, these ellipses are a lot smaller. Recall that these have the mass prior, and that's why the ellipses look so narrow, and this doesn't have the mass prior. But you could have severe biases. Okay, and here I'm showing limits on the distribution function parameter. So in this plot, I have the lag speed. Here is the RMS speed. This is what you get out of the 2015 era experiments, this black out of 2020. And this is when you put in the 10% mass prior. And so you can see that you actually do pretty well. Like, you can actually potentially get a handle on the local velocity distribution. Okay, so in current work, I'm currently trying to relax all the existing theoretical, yes.
I'm sorry. So I don't quite see how you can break the degeneracy between, I guess, the cross section and the local velocity.
Well, the cross section essentially gives you the normalization of the curve,
yeah.
But the velocities give you the recoil spectrum.
Okay, I see. So you have used information from the recoil.
Yes.
Okay.
May I ask a naive question?
Yes.
Let us say we see 20 events above background the super severeness. So you've seen something, a particle.
Yeah.
Of the mass, several hundred GeV. How do you know it's a stable particle?
Well.
What is it?
So.
It's a particle. It's
yes. I mean, the thing is, you won't be able, like, for one thing, if it were unstable on short time scales, it should have all, like, decayed into something stable. If you have something that's sort of meta-stable, like something with lifetime of order, you know, tens of gigayears, I mean, you're not going to learn everything from the direct detection experiments alone. You'll need collider information, all sorts of other information to really build the full picture. So what you'll learn is that you'll see some particle with really low elastic or inelastic cross-sections.
Mm-hmm. There could be a lot of particles being produced at the LHC in the next 10 years.
Yeah, so...
How do we notice that it's
but this is not LHC, John.
No.
This is direct detection, so...
Yeah, but it's direct detection of what?
Yeah, exactly.
He wants to connect the LHC to the direct detection.
Yeah, I mean, you really need all these different experiments in order to get a really comprehensive picture. You're not going to learn everything you want to know from one thing, or even one class of experiment. Okay, so what we're working on right now is to put in backgrounds, because before we had background-free stuff. So I'm working with this grad student at Caltech, Yuri Vucevic, on this. And we're also exploring Markov chain Monte Carlos. We want to fold in neutrino telescopes, like the information about annihilation in the sun with the Earth. We want to put in annual modulation. So because the Earth goes around the sun, it sees essentially different wind at different times of year. So we want to put that in. And also maybe put in the directionally sensitive experiments, although those are not as far along as these other ones. And we're also working on non-parametric velocity reconstruction. So I have an idea that I think is going to be awesome, but it'll be probably another 6 months before I can tell you if it is really that awesome or not so much. But I think it has the potential to be really good.
Sorry, this is to figure out the velocity distribution of the
yes.
waves from experiments.
Yes.
I have 20 questions.
No, it's 20 questions. Okay, so I realize that I'm pretty much out of time or out of time by this point. But I just wanted to say that I think there needs to be, especially because there are going to be so many exciting data sets coming in the next decade, we really need to think about what's going to happen if we actually see something, like what we're actually going to do with all these data, how we're going to learn about the dark matter particle or particles. And so I've given you an example of where I think modeling can actually give you a really accurate mapping, namely looking at the lifetimes of winds in the solar system before they thermalize. But I think even experiment or even modeling where you're not going to get exactly what you want is still useful. So for example, there are these fabulous simulations, really high resolution of Milky Way halo, Milky Way mass halos. But the thing that they're missing are baryons. And even if you don't get the baryon physics totally right, you would not have found a dark disk using those fabulous simulations. So my point is that even if you don't understand all the processes of galaxy evolution exactly, like there's still a lot to be learned from the simulations. But what I think is we need to think more about is getting more information about dark matter astrophysics from the data, not just about the particle physics. And so what I would hope is that eventually we will become like the dark energy people and start having ellipse plots like this. So here, this is sort of the equation of state of dark energy. This is sort of what's running with redshift. And these different experiments have different degeneracies, but if you put all these things together, you get maybe a better idea of what's going on in the dark energy sector. And maybe you could do something similar with dark matter. Obviously, the signal to noise is not going to be anywhere near like the dark energy. But I think we need to start thinking maybe along this direction. And what I really mean by this is what we need to also be thinking about how the different data sets that are going to be around complement each other. So for example, like I talked at the beginning of the talk about the spherically diffuse emission. In this case, the annihilation cross-section is completely degenerate with the density distribution of dark matter in halos, which is like not that great if you want to know the annihilation cross-section. But you can maybe also learn about the loop mass and some ring train fractions from the data. But it would be even better if you had some more information from colliders. You can reduce some of these uncertainties. And then another data set which might exist in 10 years is microlensing in galaxies. So actually, you look at strong lensing of AGM by galaxy type halos. And if there's substructures in these halos, they can change the flux ratios of the different images, can change the positions, and also change the relative timing of time-varying events in the AGM. And so you can potentially learn about the subhalo mass function in galaxy mass halos. Now you can maybe feed into here and try to get a better constraint on the annihilation cross-section. So basically the main point of this plot is that it's time to start thinking about the ways in which potential data sets are going to fit together. And there's been a lot of this, but I think there could be more of this, especially in terms of astronomers talking to particle physicists, which they tend, in general, not to do. Okay. So in conclusion, I hope I've convinced you that there's significant uncertainty in dark matter astrophysics, but that you can maybe learn something about this by either doing better modeling or doing some modeling and then thinking a lot more about the interpretation. Or even doing some sort of crude modeling but stuff that's still like pretty insightful. Like finding out about the dark disk just by tossing some baryons with some physics into your simulations. I ran through a couple of solar system examples of looking at annihilation of dark matter in the sun to show how modeling can actually give you some good mapping, and also how you can do some data mining to get the local distribution function. And in the future, I'm working on more of this, but in general, it would also be good to move beyond WIMP-specific experiments and try to come up with some framework of using data sets to identify dark matter. Okay, thank you. Yes.
I have a, so what fraction of a dark halo mass do you think will end up in the dark disk?
Not a huge fraction, because again, if you're talking about the several most massive subhalos come into the galaxy. And if you consider the fact that if you have too big of a subhalo, you essentially disrupt the disk. That means that you don't have a lot of mass in there, but it is like really at the center of the potential, so it becomes important for dark detection.
So you said they give me a number.
So, So like if you consider a 10 to the 12 solar mass halo, and you probably have a couple of things of a few times 10 to the 10 come in, then you know, probably no more than 10%. You also like lose some of the stuff as it's tidally stripped as it moves into the center. So it's only going to be like, you know, I would guess at most of 5-ish%.
At the solar radius. So.
Oh, at the solar radius, the density can be almost comparable to the halo density.
The local density?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, the local density is of order of unity, the dark disk density. But again, it depends quite a bit on the merger history. So. The dark disk stuff is still in early days, really. Yes?
So I'm just curious, when you say microscopic, I usually think of 10 to the minus 32 centimeters.
Okay, no.
Something about the scale even.
Very powerful microscopic.
So when you say microscopic structure, what's the scale are you talking about?
So what's really relevant for direct detection is anything that's of order sort of like AU-ish. So, yeah, clearly not 10 to the minus 32 centimeters.
Another question, which I think you almost solicited, which is, so even when you showed that dark matter, dark energy, quote unquote, plot, that was a parametric plot, right? With some strange choice of people thought were the right parameters. But you said you had a way, you might have a way of doing, without any parameters.
Of treating the velocity.
The velocity distribution, right. Yeah, not dark energy, no, velocity distribution. That sounds impossible, so.
Well, I think it's something that you have to be careful with, but I think it is possible. So currently there's a group that tries to do it by basically binning their data and looking at bins in velocity space, but I think you can do better than that. So I have an idea of how to do it. I mean, it's still in some sense parametric because you have to put something in, but it's a much more flexible framework than the things that are currently used. But I don't want to say
do not go on the side if I can see.
It's not like, you know, the most genius idea ever, but it is like something that no one has used before in this particular context. So we'll see how it works out. I don't know if it'll be fantastic or that the signal to noise will just be too bad for it to be useful. But you've got to try something.
All right.
Perhaps I've gone on long enough.
Okay, well, let's think.